Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And once again, we are joined by Stephen Katz. He is the state chair, the New York state chair for the Socialist Party USA. And Stephen Katz, he will be joining us today to discuss the rich calculate profits, the poor calculate debt. And the reason why we're getting into this discussion at this time of year, we have millions of Americans going to the various retail stores and outlets, spending countless sums of money to purchase gifts and to be able to enjoy the holidays. And then after the holidays, many of us will be sitting at our living room and dining room tables trying to figure out how we're going to pay these debts. And Stephen, once again, I would like to thank you for joining the program today.
Thank you, Stuart. It's always a pleasure to be on and discuss these issues that are not being covered over the mainstream media, or at least in any great depth.
And Stephen, you know, I just want to start the program by sharing my own personal experience. A lot of times, right, when I talk to people, they say young people today, they don't understand what poverty is like. And many times I'm talking to someone in their 70s or 80s, they start, right, telling me their stories. But trust me, I understand what poverty is about. My parents, they were living in the Watts district of Los Angeles back in the 50s. And my dad, he had those periods where he was unemployed. I mean, he didn't have work. And it was seven children, and it was two adults, my mother and my father.
Right.
And I can remember many times, Stephen, when my mother and my father, they would sit down at the kitchen table, and they would be, you know, discussing how would they be paying their bills. And then at the beginning of the month, the landlord would show up at the door and was saying, I need the money. And my dad would be giving him some type of excuse about how he didn't have the money then, but how he would try to work that out over the next few days and a few weeks. And this is the story of many millions of Americans across the country. Alan every other week.
I know.
Stephen, this is the dilemma that millions of Americans are facing every year. And then we go out, shopping, and then I can think about those times when we would go shopping just for necessities. We didn't have to necessarily wait for the holidays, Stephen, and we would go out shopping at the various thrift shops and the thrift stores and just to try to get some clothes replace shoes that were flapping at the bottom, or shoes that didn't have any more heels left, pants and shirts that were torn and ragged, and just going to these thrift stores so we could replace those items. So my story, Stephen, is a story that you can hear across the nation, where people, poor people, are suffering this every day. But, Stephen, can you relate to that type of poverty? Because I know you see this in New York City. It wasn't just in California, but, Stephen, it's there in New York as well.
It's very obvious, and, you know, I myself grew up in a working-class family where I know what it's like. As a child, I knew what it was like to be served with eviction notices, and my father was out of work from time to time, so I had.
And how did you deal with that when he was out of work? How did the family struggle through those periods?
Well, it was very difficult, and my mother had various ways of... She would move the family, And in those days, sometimes you could get a month or two of free rent to go into a new building. And, you know, she'd take us there with a month or two of free rent, then she'd pay a few months. And, you know, by the time she would fall behind and they would serve eviction proceedings, you know, at least we were there. We had roofs over our head for 6 months, you know. And I call it the resourcefulness of the impoverished.
So you know firsthand what poverty is all about.
I do. I don't come from a middle-class family, and I worked my way through through college through law school. And fortunately, back in the 60s when I was in college, there were various student aid programs, and I was able to get scholarships and student aid that they had in those days, which basically are, for most of the population today, not available anymore. Now they're loading down the students with huge debts that they cannot repay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, but to
you
go
know,
back to your original point, you know, it definitely leaves its mark on you.
It leaves its mark,
you know,
okay.
It does. It takes years, you know, to separate from that fundamental insecurity that you have when you grow up in these kinds of circumstances. And I think a little bit of it, no matter how far you go in life in terms of trying to develop yourself, there's always a little bit of it inside you.
I can remember one time also, Stephen, when my father and I, we took a trolley to downtown Los Angeles, and the big stores where you could go in and you could purchase various vegetables, you could various grains, you could purchase beans, and they would fill those up in the morning. But what they did is early in the morning, they cleaned them out first. And my dad, I was small at the time. I was, I believe, 8 years old or just turned 9. But we got on the trolley, we went downtown, and my dad asked if he could clean out the bins, because he said, my family's hungry, and
right.
If we could clean the bins. In other words, they would clean the bins, and then they would put in the new whatever products that they would put in those bins.
Right.
And my dad just went down that whole long section just cleaning it out. And then for the next week and a half or so, Stephen, all we were eating were beans. I mean, it was kind of unpleasant as far as a whole house full of people eating beans, but at least our stomachs were full. But I can tell you, Stephen, firsthand, I can understand, and I can tell people I do know what poverty is about, and I experienced this through the beginning years of my life, and even today, Stephen, I still have those times when I have to sit down with my wife and myself, and we need to struggle through our bills and figure out how are we going to be able to make ends meet.
Right.
But as I mentioned, when we look at America today, Stephen, have 48 million people. One out of every six Americans are depending on some type of government assistance. So one out of six, 48 million people. And now we have the government at where we are today. They're saying we need to start making cuts in programs, such as the SNAP program, which is used to benefit many children and families as far as with food stamps. Before, they call it food stamps, but the government is talking about making cuts in those programs, Medicare, various senior programs. But the government is talking about making these cuts that many of the poor people need to just to survive. And I just want you to comment on that, because we're going to get into the wealth of the wealthiest in our society, which is mind-blowing. But, I mean, Stephen, when you look at many millions of people went to the polls in 2008, and they voted for Obama because they thought it was going to be some type of change. But Stephen, it was anything but change. It was a change for the worse.
It certainly doesn't look like there's been any improvement. As you said, it looks like we're going backwards in almost every area. And just to show you how the priorities are, the amount that is being cut by not renewing the extended federal unemployment program, that money is going to restore cuts to the defense budget, in which all these defense contractors are making billions upon billions of dollars with all these endless wars that are going on. So, I mean, the priorities are the extremely wealthy, you know, they will spend any amount of our money that we pay into the government to protect their wealth. But as far as the people who are producing the wealth, and labor creates all value in society, that's a simple truth that I think anybody can recognize if they're not dazzled, you know, by the commodity advertisements. They can know that it is not capital that creates value; it's labor. Capital is actually a congealed and dead labor. So that capital comes from labor. It's a secondary result. But this is systemic to the capitalist system. And this is not an aberration. This is not a matter of bad policy. This is systemic to the capitalist system. It was analyzed in great detail and very brilliantly by Karl Marx more than 150 years ago. And these cycles of expansion and contraction are built into the system. We
have
to be in the downside now where unemployment goes up, wages are driven down, bankruptcies clear out, the smaller or weaker work organizations, and it's part of the normal process. In fact, Marx said, and this is... I think his work is being is more relevant today than ever. He said that he said that the capitalists keep what he called an industrial reserve army of labor for two reasons: to keep wages down, because you're not going to fight very hard for wages when you know there's 100 guys ready to step into your job. You're just glad to have the job, so you're not going to push very hard if you're not going to try to go for a union, and you know, also the fact that it disciplines workers. It not only keeps the wages lower, but it disciplines the workers because they know that the capitalists can replace them within 2 hours. And,
right. If they don't stay in line, they'll quickly get them, take them out of the workplace, and replace them.
Right. The only solution for this is a socialist state that can provide full employment. Only a socialist state can provide full employment, which is that everybody who is physically able and wants to work will be given a job, if not a job in small business, they'll be given a job in the state, environmental or ecological care and cleanup, the production of artwork, the production of, the major industries will be socialized or nationalized, and there will not be any problem. During the 1930s the Soviet Union, and this was a time when the capitalist world was in depression, where there was 25 to 30% unemployment. In the 1930s, the Soviet Union did not have enough workers. In fact, some workers here, I met somebody at a meeting a couple of years ago, and he was telling me that they were booming over there because the state was in control and allocating investment and development, and you know there were unemployed workers here, which this is something that's not generally known, that went over to work in the Soviet Union because they couldn't find jobs here. People who were...
Well, I didn't know that myself.
Yeah,
that's the first time I've ever heard that.
Yes, people who were construction workers. And I think, and it's a matter of historical record, if you do some research, you'll find that in the 1930s, the Soviet Union was booming. And this is what is possible if we had a socialist state. Even under the New Deal, where the state was directly putting people to work, not this this stuff where they give money to banks and private businesses and those, and they take it and speculate with it. This is the state that would directly put people to work. All this so-called stimulus money has not cured our unemployment because it hasn't gone to the creation of jobs. It's gone to speculation. Whereas if the federal government were putting people directly to work, two things would happen. Number one, immediately people would be employed. They don't have to wait for a private business to decide that, you know, that, okay, they have so much profit, maybe they'll hire a few more people. Everybody would be on a payroll, and that money would immediately go out for necessities, just like you were talking about when you were growing up. People will go out, they'll buy clothing, they'll buy food, they'll repair their cars, or they'll buy a used car, or whatever the case may be.
But I want to ask you,
yeah,
Stephen, we have a big problem, boulder that's in the middle of the road, because, I mean, here we have a president, and just recently we saw that, you know, he has supported, you know, the continuation of what Ben Bernanke, what he has already done. And
right.
Then he came and nominated Janet Yellen to be the head of the Federal
right.
Reserve. Now, here this woman, I mean, she's basically going to continue what Bernanke has already been doing. I mean, he was shelling out $85 billion, with a B, $85 billion a month
right.
into the private markets. These monies
right.
are not going to assist any of the poor people.
No.
And if you look at within recent years, this administration and the Federal Reserve has shelled out over $3 trillion to the financial markets and to Wall Street. $3 trillion. With $3 trillion over that same period of time, they would have been able to eliminate poverty in the U.S. Yet we have
right.
seen the wealth of the wealthiest in our society increase at a staggering, a mind-blowing
right.
rate. So,
well,
I mean, when we talk about
you know,
the possibilities, why, I mean, we have an administration that is overlooking even the minimum possibilities of eliminating poverty and creating more hardships by saying we're going to make cuts in these programs and those programs and
well,
even
because,
cut out some of the most basic
it's all
needs.
Within,
so where do we start?
It's all within the parameters of the capitalist system. And to my knowledge, FDR, and to a certain extent also Lyndon Johnson, began to think a little bit beyond, not much, but enough so that, you know, they were willing to put they were willing to use some of the state in the interest of the masses of people and not in the interest of a small group of corporate and finance and military industrial capitalists. And we don't need the Federal Reserve, and we don't need to be paying interest to borrow money. The state can
well,
put out
was,
its own
explain,
money.
Explain to our
yeah.
listeners why the Federal Reserve was even created. You say we don't need it. Why
we
was it created?
Well,
why
was
it created, though?
It was created by the banks so that they can make a lot of money. That's why
exactly.
it was created.
It was
but
created by the banks.
It,
they wanted
necessary.
To control the money supply of the nation.
Right.
And they've been
right.
doing that since 1913.
As far as I know, and, of course, the Federal Reserve, I think it's going into its 100th anniversary, Woodrow Wilson signed the initial legislation. A lot of people don't realize that the Federal Reserve is a consortium of private banks. Many people think it's part of the government. It's not part of the government.
They think it's part of the government.
Yeah, it isn't. It's private. And
right.
In fact, Woodrow Wilson who became quite ill towards the end of his presidency. But after he signed that bill, he stated, it's reported that he stated that he said, what have I done? He says, this is, he said, I made a major mistake here. He said, I've betrayed my country. That's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
As far as has been reported.
Right.
But, you know, it's not necessary. The state can print its can put out its own legal tender, and it has the power to tax. It has all the resources at its disposal. It can hire people, and it doesn't have to pay a penny in interest. And the sooner we abolish the Federal Reserve, the better off we're all going to be.
People
not
need
only
to understand how
bad.
I say people need to also understand how wealth is created. Wealth in the world, first of all, is created by the banks, and wealth
right.
is created out of nothing. It's created
right.
out of nothing. They create the wealth, and then they put the people to work. People go to factories. They go to these businesses that are owned by the wealthiest in our society.
Right.
And then the monies that we borrow for these dirty wars and all that, we end up having to pay money back with interest. They create the money, they loan the money, just like even your credit card, they loan you the money, and then they say, all right, pay us back with interest, instead
right.
of you having the wealth for yourself. But on the scale of government, they just do it on a much larger level.
Oh, well, I mean, it reminds me when I was growing up in Brooklyn, my father, who grew up in the Brownsville ghetto, used to tell me stories that, you know, when people were short on cash, they'd go to what was called the loan sharks. Basically,
I heard about those in L.A.
Right. I mean, it's not unique to to New York.
Right.
They're all in every major city where if you couldn't get the money from the bank, you'd go to the loan sharks, and they charge you very high interest. But some of the interest that's being charged on credit cards and in other spheres, including interest against the government, is equivalent to loan sharking. You know
exactly.
And
I want to take a short pause just to reintroduce our guest for today. We have Stephen Katz. He is a state chair for the Socialist Party USA there in New York. He joins our program every other week, and the alternating week is Alan Mackey. That's why I've been kind of mixing the two names today, but and I apologize, Stephen. But Stephen, today Stephen is joining the program to discuss holidays. The rich calculate profits, the poor calculate debt. And
right.
one of the things that I put out when we were this was posted, will be that we're going to also discuss the hypocrisies of capitalism. And we see many of the big retailers are encouraging working people to just give. And then on in other parts of our communities, we see cities and local governments, they are making threats of fines and also arrests for people giving to the poor, the homeless, and the most needy in our society. And if we want to talk about hypocrisy, the hypocrisy of a capitalist system, and you have to understand that these local governments and these counties and municipalities, they're only doing what they're instructed to do by their handlers, the people that installed
right.
them into office.
Right.
So I hope you didn't lose your thought what you were saying, Stephen.
Well, in reference to this, you know, we had this here. They call it quality of life things. The thing is that the society of late capitalism has become quite narcissistic. By that I mean is that there's a lot of people who, in comfortable circumstances, who are made uncomfortable when they see somebody sleeping on a grate, or when they see somebody lining up at a soup kitchen or whatever. So the powers that be, you know, try to get it out of sight. And I think a lot of these programs are directed to trying to get it out of sight, or trying to get it to move to another area of the country. And, of course, it's distressful, and it is a commentary, and it also makes it quite obvious that we're living in a society of extremes, extreme wealth and increasing poverty, and this is something that the powers that be want to keep suppressed, and they want to keep off the radar. And, you know, so a lot of these local laws are directed towards that. Many of them, I believe, are unconstitutional. But another thing which has happened is that the ability to challenge these laws is very limited because public interest lawyers, in the 60s, you had funds for lawyers for people, you know, that were paid by the federal government, and of course they cut all of that out except for criminal defense, which is mandated by the Sixth Amendment. And you know, to go back to the original point, I just think that a lot of this is directed towards suppressing it. Now, on the subways in New York, which I take quite frequently because it would be it's madness to try to drive into Manhattan, and you know, I work occasionally in Manhattan. You know, there's a lot of panhandling on the subways now, and they constantly tell you don't give to people who are, you know, going through the cars. Some people are playing music and trying to entertain people. Some people are just, they come into the subway car where you're sitting, and they begin to tell a whole story, and most of them, I think, are true. Occasionally, you might get somebody who's looking to buy a bottle of wine and goes, makes up a story, but a lot of them have had, you know, hard luck stories of losing jobs, of losing homes, and all kinds of stuff. But
right.
They don't, the authorities don't want you really to support this, give any money to this. They do come around when it's cold and try to get people in shelters and so on, which, you know, does have some value, but a lot of people are afraid to go to shelters because of the insecurity there. And so the answer is that a lot of these so-called quality of life laws, that they try to get the poor out of sight so that those in better circumstances are not distressed, and so that the myth of the affluent society can be perpetuated.
You know, some of the things I see, Stephen, when I look at, you know, the wealthiest in our societies and their functionaries, such as I look back when President Ronald Reagan, when he was making a statement to the press, and he was talking about the USDA daily requirements to meet our supplemental needs, and how the president, apparently he had gotten some information. I wouldn't say it was bad information for him, but it was bad information that he revealed. But he was saying to help meet one's daily nutritional requirement, that all you had to do would be just to consume ketchup. And this was met with outrage, that here the president was saying to the poor and the needy in our society that
right.
You can meet your daily requirements by eating ketchup. And but they say it was taken out of context. It doesn't matter. That's what he said. But I can't remember sometimes when my family, when we were at times without food, it was ketchup and bread. Sometimes it was
right.
syrup and bread. Sometimes
right.
milk and bread. And sometimes
right.
it was just bread.
Right.
But here, when you have the wealthiest in our society and their functionaries, a president is saying that you can eat bread and this is enough, where on the other hand, the people that install him in the office, he's feeding them, you know, the best that society has to offer. And this is the way that the wealthiest in our society, the way that they look at the poor, is just enough just to keep you alive. And we could see that even during the time of Karl Marx, during the time of slavery in the country, just enough to keep them alive.
Yeah, well, basically what Marx said is that the income of the worker is geared to keeping him in a state so he can return to work the following day and make profit for the capitalist, which
exactly.
means he has to have a certain level of nutrition and a certain level of educational skill. Of course, back in the days of Marx, it was a lot less than it would be today in many areas. But there's two stories I recently heard that very much supports what you're saying. The McDonald's Corporation, which produces all the fast food and I don't know how many billions or millions of hamburgers they produce every year, has been reported as telling their employees to eat smaller portions if mm-hmm. they cannot afford, if they don't feel that their wages are sufficient to sustain them. And, of course, we know there's a movement throughout the country for unionization among fast food workers. And this is a report that has come out in the media that's one thing. And the other thing is another report that around Thanksgiving that Walmart was collecting food and had food bins for its own workers. So to get the workers who were better
this
to get
Walmart.
The customers, Walmart, to get their customers mm-hmm. and perhaps workers who had a little bit more money, maybe because you had two people working in a family or whatever, to donate food so that the workers, the other workers who couldn't afford much in the way of food could have more food during the holiday. So that, I think, goes along with Reagan's ketchup remark. But if you see the food they serve in these state dinners and all that, I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, it's gourmet on top of gourmet stuff that they serve there.
And we're going to focus a little bit more on the wealthy in our society, because when we see the wealthy in our society, what it's doing is creating more of the poor in our society as well. But it says in the 2012 fiscal year, $74.6 billion in food assistance was distributed.
Right.
As of September 2012, 47.7 million Americans were receiving an average of $134.29 per month in
right.
food assistance. More than 15% of the U.S. population received food assistance. They're talking about like per meal, like $1.50 per meal. I was watching something also on the internet where they were talking about how someone could shop and be able to get a nutritional diet for a period of a week by picking up certain items. But when you're calculating less than $1.50 per meal, Stephen, this is not even for real. I mean, now you're eating either junk food or you're not properly getting the proper nutrition that you need for your body. And this is what is happening to the poor in our society. And just give you a comment on that, and then we're gonna talk about how the wealth, how they're living.
Well, I mean, you know, as far as that's concerned, the what was I gonna say? There is a lot of private efforts by private charity, and I include not only church charities, but also we have something here called Meals on Wheels, and we have City Harvest, and I occasionally send some contributions to an organization in the city that goes to different restaurants and gets food which is still edible, is still fresh enough, and brings it to different. They collect it, the restaurants donate it, and they bring it to different food pantries and different food kitchens. But the problem with voluntary charity is that when you have such high unemployment and such insecurity, the amount of money that people can give and are willing to give drops quite substantially, and that the private charities cannot make up for what if the federal government cuts back not only shouldn't that be a cutback, there should be an increase. It should be taken out of the bloated and totally unnecessary imperialist defense budget. And there's enough there to have nutritious and healthy food for everybody in cafeterias throughout the United States, you know, at minimal cost or in some cases even at no cost. So, I mean, you know, it's a matter of priorities. And, of course, poor and working people are the first to suffer cutbacks because they are powerless. And the powerful have lobbyists to watch out for their interests, you know, in Washington and in the state houses throughout the country. And this is a, you know, this is what the situation is. And the conservatives are always saying, well, look, you know, the concern, give a private charities, but it's been shown that private charity cannot pick up the load when, like you say, you have so many people who are out of work, and you know, the need is just so great that it's I get so many letters, it's just unbelievable, from so many organizations asking for money that you know, and I'm not alone. I mean,
and see, the thing is, you can't expect for private charities to take care of all of this, because in a society, the government collectively, we have a responsibility, and we appoint those leaders to be able to make certain that the collective needs are met for all, and it's not being done. You know, And what?
And there's some other interesting statistic and observation that I came across within the last week, and that is that the small businesses and the people within the country who would normally hire people are doing just as badly as they did in 2008, whereas because the money is not being invested here, it's being invested overseas, where jobs are being created in very low-wage markets by international corporations. So
I'm just going to take I'm going to take another short break here just to mention that we do have Stephen Katz. He's joining our program. Once again, he's with the Socialist Party USA, and he is the New York State Chair for the SPUSA. He's joining our program today to discuss holidays. The rich calculate profits, the poor calculate debt.
Right.
And we're going to have Stephen on. He's going to be on the 30th also, and in that segment, he's going to be discussing another topic. Is it too late for socialism to save America?
I'm really looking forward to that.
During this segment, Stephen will share his projections for 2016. Has the damage been done, and can the next president make a difference? So I'm looking forward to that one. And also on the 23rd of this month, we're going to have Alan Mackey next week. Alan Mackey will be joining the program once again, and he will be discussing the American Revolution and the revolution that began after the revolution. We have to realize that what took place more than 200 years ago, the revolution that took place in America, there was a revolution that began the same day than when the working people thought that, oh, we just had a revolution. and the revolution that was created within the revolution has been going on ever since, and unfortunately has been working against working people. But today we're glad to have Stephen joining our program today.
Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be
Stephen.
An interesting one. Thank you. So it was a pleasure to
you always make it interesting. I'm looking forward to what you have to say about that. You know, Stephen, if we talk about the you read the World Socialist website all the time, and I'm glad you do. And one of the things they had was wealth and poverty in America. It says the top 10 highest paid CEOs in the United States each received over $100 million last year. $100 million last year, according to a survey released Tuesday by GMI Rating. Two chief executives alone took in over $1 billion apiece, and the combined pay of the top 10 was $4.7 billion in 1 year.
Unbelievable.
I mean, we're talking about poverty.
Right.
Stephen, the wealth at the top is running over. Help me out.
Well, I tell you that more and more the United States is beginning to look like Russia looked prior to the revolution in 1917. And I say that because if you read the histories of the condition of society, and I'm not suggesting that we are in the same dire straits as they are, but relatively speaking, we certainly are heading to a similar confrontation. You know, the amount of poverty, the amount of unemployment, the wars that were going on, the ruling class, which was completely insulated and totally indifferent to the plight of the masses of people. I would recommend Leon Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution, in which he talks about how the Tsar, during all of this that was going on, even in the year before the revolution, if you look at his journal, he was writing down, well, I went hunting today, and tomorrow so-and-so is going to visit me, and, you know, completely unconcerned about anything. And also John Reed, 10 Days That Shook the World. John Reed is a member of the Socialist Party USA in the very early days, and the movie Reds is based on his life, which I would recommend highly. In his book, 10 Days That Shook the World, you see how the entire society finally woke up and the people took the power into their own hands and they completely overthrew the existing state and they instituted their own institutions. They took over the factories and offices. Land was distributed to the peasants and they finally ended the war with Germany and Austria, and it was a tremendous period of time which gave hope to people throughout the world, and we have the 100th anniversary of that great revolution coming up in just a few years. So, what I'm pointing out is that things constantly change. There is a dialectic. And the conditions that exist in the United States today cannot exist indefinitely. They cannot exist indefinitely.
I see wherever it sets down, whether we look at China, now China has 157 billionaires. It has more billionaires than any other country other than the U.S.
Right.
Capitalism touched down in Russia. I was surprised.
Right.
I read something the other day that Vladimir Putin is one of the wealthiest men in the world. He's worth over $35 billion. $35 billion with poverty all over Russia.
Right.
So capitalists, what they do is they take care of their CEOs. They take care of their functionaries.
Right.
But the poor, you see the poverty and the decay, the despair all over these societies, whether it's the U.S. or whether it's China or whether it's any country where capitalism is.
The only answer to this is an answer that was developed in the past 200 years, and that is we need socialist states throughout the globe. And we need an international socialist order in which production is to meet human need and not for profit, and a basically decent life and education and health is guaranteed for every human being. It is within the technological and material capacities of humanity to do that right now. It cannot be done while capitalism exists. Capitalism will have to be transcended.
Well, you know, Stephen, you know, you sort of lead me in another direction here, because I know next week we say we're going to pick up on this. Has the damage been done?
I'm
Stephen, let's face it. I mean, they have taken over the armies. They have taken over the militaries of many countries. They have taken over the banks. They have taken over the local police departments. They have taken over the government. They have taken over the Constitution. They're in your backyard. They're in your front yard. They're when you pick up your phone. So, Stephen, I mean, you say we need to have a change of the order, the political order. Where do you start when they are everywhere?
Well, I mean, the point is, and it's not only the United States domestically, internationally, we need a socialist order. I mean, there's no question about it.
Well,
and
I understand we need it.
Well,
I know we say we need it by organizing, but they have infiltrated, and we can even see by, Edward Snowden, much of the information that came out, even in the WikiLeaks. I mean, we can see that they have entered into every facet of society and the government and into every facet of one's life. Even when you go on Facebook now, everything that you're putting on Facebook is being carefully scrutinized, and they take off what they want to take off and include what they want to include.
I mean, I could say this, and it goes back to the fundamental insight that labor creates all value. Every day of the week here and throughout the world, but I'll talk about this country, which obviously we know the best. Truckers are trucking food and clothing. Clothing is being produced, much of it overseas, but also domestically. All kinds of products that make our daily existence possible are being produced by labor. And if labor and stop laboring for 2 weeks, the society would come to a complete grinding halt. Civilization could not survive an indefinite general strike, either here in the United States or throughout the world. The working class has the power to, and it's not as hard as it sounds, to peacefully put down their stop their trucks, put down their instruments, and just go on strike.
I understand that, Stephen, but one thing I have to look at, and I'm going to go back 150 years, is like saying the workers need to go on strike, but I look at around the time of slavery, and you say, the slaves, they need to rebel against the plantation owner. But you had half the slaves, they didn't realize they were in slavery. They thought that everything was okay.
Well,
they thought that they were free.
Yes. You do have...
And we have the same thing today. We have people walking around with their cell phones that think that, as long as I can be able to talk to my friends and, so what if I don't have a job? So what if, I'm able to get $1.50 a day just to eat, But they don't realize that they have a problem. And you have millions of Americans with this mindset. Since we're talking about this country, I want to talk about the mindset that's in this country that millions of people say if they go 2 weeks, but you have over half the nation say, well, there's nothing wrong other than Obama, but everything else is okay.
Well,
but everything
is
not okay.
There is a very high degree of what I call mass psychological control by the corporate media, the capitalist media, 24/7, through various news outlets and through the culture. That is true. However, it does have a limit, and the limit is if people's very survival is being threatened, that will tend to sober anybody up. And there's an old saying that I like from Groucho Marx, where he used to say, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? Well, eventually people start believing their own eyes. I mean, that's what I think happened with Occupy when a lot of people, not only the young, but, some older people too, woke up and said, you know what, we have to do something about this. We don't exactly know how to go about it, and maybe a lot of us are young, but we have to stop this somehow. Now, it may have been short-lived, but you know what they say, it's like a leaf in the wind, or it's like the snow, that the early dusting of snow right before a blizzard. You know, there are little signs that
right.
That come up, and if there is any further crisis, and what I have to say is this: if there is another very major economic crisis, which is not containable, if there is another major war, and this, if you, particularly if you follow the World Socialist website, but you don't even need to do that. All you have to do is read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. There's increasing tension between the United States and China. And in many
right.
ways, throughout that particular region and the Middle East, we're entering an era that looks eerily like the one before World War I, when the competing imperialists, you know, started to rub up against each other, and eventually a spark was ignited and a war broke out. I mean, if we had a major war, a really major war, I'm not talking about these wars, which are tragic and a lot of people lose their lives, but are more or less contained to one or two countries like Iraq or Afghanistan or some unrest in civil wars in Libya, Syria. But I'm talking about wars among major powers like China, the U.S., Japan is being rearmed now, which is not a good idea, in my opinion. You know,
Well, the reason why war is not the answer, even a war on those scales where you're talking about the world going at war,
right.
because, you know, it's their wars. It's not our war. It's their wars.
No, I know.
And it's our blood.
What happens
and that's
is,
the way, that's
know,
the way wars are.
I know. What happens is, though.
And I'm not, and Stephen, I know you're not advocating war.
No.
But, you know, and unfortunately, that's where it leads to because
right.
war is the greatest accumulator of wealth for the rich. I mean, that's what it leads to. And
yeah,
also, people need to understand, it's the greatest accumulation, consolidation of power for the super wealthy
yes.
in a society.
Yes, it is. And it also
so it benefits the wealthy in two ways.
Right. In three ways, because it also allows the ruling classes to clamp down domestically under the theory that any kind of dissent is helping the enemy. So, you know, it serves their purposes in many, many ways. However, it does create crises. And if a draft ever had to be reignited and reinstituted, and it will definitely have to be brought back if there is a major conflagration either in the Middle East or particularly with a country like China you know, because, I mean, you know, China has a multi-million man army. I mean, even with all the high-tech weapons in the world, unless you're starting to talk about nuclear war, which all of the powers on Earth know would be mass suicide. I mean,
right.
it does bring on crises. And if you look, I go back to, as different as it was, there were many similarities. I go back to Russia before the Russian Revolution, where World War I completely created such a crisis and such an opening for revolutionary transformation in Russia that it brought on a revolution. And, you know, between the ill-equipped soldiers and the starvation and the collapse of the economy and on and on and on, you know, these things do have a tendency to have unintended consequences and also to create crises that are not containable. And although don't want to see it happen. I mean, I would like to see a peaceful transition to a society in which a truly human society in which the needs of masses of people are safeguarded by their state. Sometimes in history, the dialectic doesn't work that way, you know, and it has to get a hell of a lot worse before it can suddenly get better.
Stephen, I just want to touch on a few things. We only have around five more minutes here,
right.
I want to touch on a couple other things. When we talk about things that we can do to help the poor, the
right.
Socialist Party USA, they're advocating a living wage and also
right.
a minimum of $15
right.
per hour.
Right.
What is the possibilities of that even happening
within
the next decade?
It will happen if increasingly more and more of the fast food workers are unionizing, there's more and more support, and the minimum wage will come up. And once the minimum wage will come up, all of the other wage scales are going to come up, and it will actually improve employment throughout the society as well. Demand will rise. Now, will it come up to 15 immediately? No. But it will provide an impetus to push it in that direction. And
now, one of the other things yeah. that the Socialist Party USA and other socialist groups have talked about is a guaranteed income for all. What is
right.
your ideas on that? A guaranteed basic income for all.
Well, I mean, it is within the technological and material capacities of. Certainly of the United States, and if all of the societies and countries cooperated throughout the world, it would be possible throughout the world on varying scales, depending on the development of the societies, that, you know, every human being, by virtue of being alive, shall have the right to shelter, food, education, and culture, and the right to work or the right to a job, and if a job is not temporarily available or is not available for a long period of time, none of those basic support human rights would be taken away. You know, because remember one thing, in capitalist society, you cannot eat unless you make a profit for some capitalist.
Right.
By virtue of being alive, now we're not talking about religious institutions, we're talking about the broad mass of the economy and society throughout the world. If you don't make profit for some capitalist, you cannot eat and you cannot put a roof over your head. And the capitalists consider labor not to be human beings with needs, capacities, and so on and so forth, but labor is a cost and labor is something that cuts at the profit. As long as you have this type of inhuman system, you're going to have the extremes of wealth, poverty, and ultimately mass impoverishment. This whole murderous system has to be transcended, has to be changed, and we have to develop a truly human civilization. It is in the human potential to do this, and I think it's really the only thing worth fighting for. It's not something that could happen in one generation, but all of us in every generation have a responsibility to do whatever we can to bring this about in whatever way we can, be it limited or some of us, you know, fortunately may have opportunities to make more of a contribution. But whatever you can do, whatever we can do, we should do.
Well, we only have just another minute or so. I just want to mention
yeah.
Stephen Katz. He has been our guest today. He'll be back one in 2 weeks. The discussion at that time will be, is it too late for socialism to save America? And how can our listeners be able to reach you, Stephen?
I can be reached at the National Office of the Socialist Party USA at 339 Lafayette Street, New York, New York. And I'm also on the National Committee of the Socialist Party USA. I just went on after this convention we had. And so if anyone wants to communicate, they can certainly do so. I do believe we have a calling capacity, don't we, on the show? So,
well, we'll bring that up next week because right now
right.
we're out of time.
Okay,
thanks again
right.
for joining us, Stephen, and we look forward to having you to
okay.
join us 2 weeks from now.
Stuart,
thanks again.
I can't wait to come back. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Ruth.
Have a
okay.
good night. Good night, everyone.
You too.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Thank you, Ruth. Bye-bye.
Much good night.